From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, nearly full moon open lines. And do we have an amazing guest for you in just a few minutes? So stand by. Here's what's happening. A Secret Service officer shot an armed man who approached the White House complex Friday afternoon with a weapon in plain sight. He refused to drop it in an incident that put the White House temporarily on lockdown. The lockdown has since been lifted, and officials say everyone at the White House is safe and accounted for. President Obama was out playing golf at the time of the incident. Vice President Biden was at the complex. He's secured. And while an official stressed that the suspect did not have access to the White House complex itself, the shooting happened within view of sightseers outside the front of the building. The suspect is in custody. He's in critical condition in a hospital, not expected to survive. Well, there's a possibility of a fire aboard that crashed Egypt Air flight. It's being discussed as body parts, debris found all over the Mediterranean now, and as these pieces of luggage, human remains, wreckage that could be a telltale oil slick as well, found early Friday in the Mediterranean. One aviation expert said telemetry received by satellites from the doomed plane suggested a fire could have started on board, knocking out computers and control mechanisms. They're still kicking around the possibility of terrorism. Nobody knows for sure yet what happened on that flight. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that it is monitoring 279 pregnant women with likely Zika virus infections all across the United States and territories. Now, the largest number of cases so far are in Puerto Rico, but here on the homeland, the United States, these cases are beginning to grow. Let's check in with one of the most important investigative medical reporters out there today, John Rappaport. John, what do you know so far about this Zika virus as it seems to get bigger and bigger here in the United States?
Well, we have to go back to Brazil, George, where this all started, because, and this is borne out in various places other than Brazil as well, the number of pregnant women or women who have babies with this birth defect called microcephaly, very few, percentage-wise, are found with any trace of the Zika virus. And this is the story behind the story that they're not really broadcasting. So in other words, they have no real evidence. And between the lines, they will admit this, that the Zika virus is the cause of this birth defect. And yet the CDC and the World Health Organization just keep pounding on the story and insisting that the evidence is clear. But I've looked at the recent studies on which these headlines are based, and the studies are extremely weak. In other words, the correlation between women whose babies have this birth defect and the presence of the Zika virus is extremely weak. It's not consistent whatsoever, and they are just overlooking that, as usual, as they've done in other cases of other so-called epidemics before.
Scare tactics, John?
Yes, and I think it also has to do, to some degree, with Brazil itself, where all this started. The Rio Olympics is really going to be an interesting event. There are lots of people that will probably be staying home that won't show up. Brazil is one of the so-called BRIC nations, along with China and Russia, India and South Africa, that are trying to break away from the globalist framework and start their own money fund and perhaps even dump the dollar as the oil currency. And they are under attack. So this provides an ideal opportunity to forward that agenda.
Okay, John. Thank you so much. As many as 40% of cancer cases and half of the cancer deaths come down to things people could easily change, according to researchers. Now, while Americans often worry about whether chemicals, pollution, or other factors out of their control cause cancer, The new analysis shows otherwise. People are firmly in charge of much of their own risk of cancer. A team at Harvard Medical School calculated that 20 to 40% of cancer patients and cases and half of the cancer deaths could be prevented if people quit smoking, avoided heavy drinking, kept healthy weight, and got just half an hour a day of moderate exercise. Just remember that. The Inspector General for the IRS said that the tax collection agency continues to be at risk of paying out billions of dollars in fraudulent earned income tax credit payments each year, and that there's nothing the IRS can do about it. The Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration released a report that said almost 25% of the payments issued last year should not have been issued. That amounts to $15.6 billion. Actor-comedian Alan Young, who played the straight man to a talking horse in the 1960s sitcom Mr. Ed, has died. He was 96.
Morning, Wilbur.
Ed, isn't this a beautiful morning?
Only for people.
What are you so grouchy about?
Didn't sleep a wink last night.
What kept you up?
The smoke from your barbecue.
What bothered you, huh?
No.
That's too bad. Still, we've got to use the barbecue.
Wanna bet?
That was Alan Young talking to the horse, Mr. Ed. Alan was already a well-known radio and television comedian, having started his own Emmy-winning variety show when Mr. Ed was being readied at comedian George Burns' production company. Burns is said to have told his staff, "Get Alan Young. He looks like the kind of a guy a horse would love to talk to." Back in November of 1963, then CBS newsman Dan Rather was in Dallas, Texas for CBS. He happened to be in the area doing some film work for the network when the tragedy to John F. Kennedy occurred. Here's Dan Rather from November 1963.
The films we saw were taken by an amateur photographer who had a particularly good vantage point just past the building from which the fatal shot was fired. The films show President Kennedy's open black limousine making a left turn off Houston Street onto Elm Street on the fringe of downtown Dallas. A left turn made just below the window in which the assassin was waiting. About 35 yards past the very base of the building, just below the window, President Kennedy could be seen to put his right hand up to the side of his head to either brush back his hair or perhaps rub his eyebrow. President Kennedy was sitting on the same side of the car as the building from which the shot came. Mrs. Kennedy was by his side in the jump seat in front of them. Mrs. Connolly and Governor Connolly. Governor Connolly on the same side of the car as the president, and in the front seat, two Secret Service men. Just as the president put that right hand up to the side of his head, you could see him lurch forward. The first shot had hit him. Mrs. Kennedy was looking in another direction and apparently didn't see or sense that first shot or didn't hear it. But Governor Connolly, in the seat in front, appeared to have heard it or at least sensed that something was wrong. The governor's coat was open. He reached back in this fashion, exposing his white shirt front to the assassin's window. He reached back as if to operate or ask the president something. At that moment, a shot clearly hit the governor in the front, and he fell back in the seat. Mrs. Connolly immediately threw herself over him in a protective position. In the next instant, with this time Mrs. Kennedy apparently looking on, a second shot, the third total shot, hit the president's head. His head could be seen to move violently forward. And Mrs. Kennedy stood up immediately. The president leaned over her way. It appeared that he might have brushed her legs. Mrs. Kennedy then literally went on the top of the trunk of the Lincoln car, put practically her whole body on the trunk. It appeared she might have been on her all fours there, reaching out for the Secret Service man, the lone Secret Service man who was riding on the bumper of the car, the back bumper on Mrs. Kennedy's side. A Secret Service man leaned forward and put his hands on Mrs. Kennedy's shoulder to push her back into the car. She was in some danger, it appeared, of rolling off or falling off. When we described this before, there was some question about what we meant by Mrs. Kennedy being on the trunk of the car. Only she knows, but it appeared that she was trying desperately to get the Secret Service man's attention, or perhaps to help pull him into the car. The car never stopped, it never paused. In the front seat, a Secret Service man was on the telephone. The car picked up speed and disappeared beneath an underpass.
That was 1963. If you were around then, you surely remember where you were. Dan Rather remembers it. He has been a witness to many episodes that we have all been part of. And in a moment, Dan Rather joins us. And he's here with us also to talk about his new ebook called Lessons from the Field. Everything I learned about life, I learned from reporting. His website is newsandgutsmedia.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, Dan Rather joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. I'm really looking forward to this over the next couple hours. Dan Rather with us, famed, storied career that has spanned more than six decades. Dan Rather has been one of the world's best-known journalists for much of the last half century. He has interviewed every president since Eisenhower. He has personally covered almost every major event over the last 60 years. Joined CBS News in 1962. He rose through the ranks quickly. In 1981, he assumed the position of anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News in a post that he held for 24-plus years. My pleasure to bring in to Coast, Dan Rather. Dan, thank you for coming and joining us.
George, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
You do not know it, but you had an incredible influence on my broadcasting career. From my days in Detroit, I went to the University of Detroit, got my broadcast degree, ended up working at your affiliate in Detroit at that time, WJBK, the CBS station, and just watched the things that you did. And I want to thank you on behalf of all the Americans for what you have done for us in bringing us the news, doing what you've done, and being as gutsy as you've been over the years. Thank you.
Well, George, thanks is mine to give. You know, when I was a child, I dreamed of being a journalist, dreamed of being a reporter. In that time and place, which was Texas in the 1930s, when I first began to dream, I dreamed of being a print reporter, but unfortunately, I was a very poor speller, which is a vital weakness to have if you want to be in the newspaper business. So I've been very lucky and blessed to live my dream. Now, you know, I'm kind of on the backside of the mountain, fair to say, but still active. And you know, I really appreciate what you just said. I'm not sure I'm worthy of all that, but I do appreciate it very much.
And you're still on the mountain. That's the important thing. That's the important thing. We lost one of your colleagues yesterday, Morley Safer, 84 years old. There's something to be said about working in this industry, Dan. You know, Mike Wallace, he worked so long. I think it keeps us young, doesn't it?
Well, I've come to believe that, that if you to do news, you have to have a passion for it. You have to burn with a hot, hard flame to do it. And I do believe that having a passion and, you know, feeling that what work you do, if you do it well, counts, it matters, it's important, and that keeps you going. And I do think it affects you, your health, both mentally and bodily. I'm not sure we can prove that scientifically, but you mentioned my old friend Mike Wallace and my friend Morley Safer, who just crossed the river. But I do think there's something to it. If you have a passion for your work and you keep working, you have a better chance to make it into your later years.
I want to spend some time talking about your career, Dan, and then we'll get into where we are today in the world through your perspective, because it's changing, and the digital world, too, which is changing the business that we have both been in and have loved for so many years. You were first noticed by CBS when you covered stories in Texas, Carla, the hurricane. They noticed your work and made you that offer to join the network. But you really took off when you were in Dallas when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Tell us that story.
Well, the outline that you just stated is pretty much the case, that I was working in the town where I grew up, Houston, as first a newspaper reporter and wire service reporter, but then got into radio and eventually wandered into television. And the great hurricane, Carla, in September of 1961, was at that time, and I believe this is still true,
the largest in terms of geographical circumference of the hurricane, the largest hurricane on record. And it was headed for the Texas coast, and I had just taken a job at the local television station, and we went to Galveston, where they had a what was then a new radar way of putting a making an image of a hurricane, mm-hmm. and we put that on television for the first time. This was before any station, radio or television, had a radar of its own, and that was, I didn't realize at the time, broke through and changed the weather reporting. And the hurricane was so big, and so with top winds at one time in excess of 200 miles an hour, so it got to be a national story. The powers that be at CBS saw our coverage. They picked it up nationally. They offered me a job, and I eventually took it. And, you know, that was a dream come true for me, speaking of dreams. And I walked among legends at CBS News, the Cronkites, the Severides, the Collingwoods, Edward R. Murrow had just left, although I met him and knew him. And, you know, I was plunged immediately into covering the civil rights movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King. It was still the rather early stages of the civil rights movement. And you're right that, you know, the hurricane was my break. One hates to talk about something as big and deadly as a monster hurricane, but that was my break in getting noticed at the network. And then, although I was on television fairly regularly covering the civil rights movement, no doubt, being in Dallas at the time President Kennedy was assassinated and being the point man for CBS News coverage during that time raised my profile. I pause a little bit to say that because, again, you know, while, yes, professionally I benefited from being a reporter on scene when the president was assassinated, let's face it, I was, as a journalist, I was blessed and lucky to be there. But like every other American, I was absolutely, you know, at least a mild state of shock while I was reporting, because it was an immense story that made a big difference in American history. And from there, I was moved to Washington to be the chief White House correspondent during the Johnson years, and then led to being a foreign correspondent overseas, and led to my being in Vietnam for the better part of a year, and I was back another three times covering the Vietnam War. So it is true that the Kennedy assassination, along with the Great Hurricane, in terms of making one's name, again, I don't like to put it that way, that's true.
You then, of course, became the White House correspondent. You covered Watergate, and you covered it very, very well. I'm going to play a very short clip. I'll always remember this. The NAB, National Association of Broadcasters, President Nixon at the time is there talking. Folks, listen to this.
I believe we are going to make progress in the economic and political fields.
President. Thank you, Mr. President. Dan Rather with CBS News. President.
Are you running for something?
No, sir, Mr. President, are you? Mr. President.
You brought the house down on that, Dan. You remember that one.
Well, what can I say? I think it's important that people who were not alive or not a memory age at the time, you know, the circumstance was that the proverbial noose was tightening around President Richard Nixon, that he was being revealed as president who was leading a widespread criminal conspiracy, and he wasn't to be in office much longer. This meeting in Houston was set up to be kind of a rally behind the president. President Nixon and those who supported him were still trying to keep him in office, and that was the context in what was happening. And, you know, my job as a reporter at the press conference is to get up and ask a question and sit down and take down the president's answer. But President Nixon had developed this technique. If you were a reporter with a reputation for asking a direct question you didn't want to ask, he always would try to throw you a little off balance. So this was a packed house, and it was pretty much a paper house with Republican supporters. So, you know, before I could ask my question, you heard I was trying to get my question, and before I could ask the question, he tried to throw me a little bit off balance. And, you know, I didn't think about it. It just happened in a nanosecond. They were boos when I got up, and some applause and some boos. And, you know, it was what it was.
But you came right back. Dan, hold on for a second. We have to hit this break. You know what that's all about. Dan Rather with us. His ebook is called Lessons from the Field. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And Dan Rather is with us for the next hour and a half as we talk about his life, as we talk about news and just what's going on in America and the world. His ebook, by the way, is called Lessons from the Field. His website, newsandgutsmedia.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dan Rather with us. Dan, we're broadcasting tonight on 615 radio stations across North America. Not quite the audience you had with CBS News, but pretty good for a radio program.
I'd say that's pretty terrific for a radio program.
So back to the clip. So Nixon tried to throw you off, and you came right back at him. And you came back quickly, and it's a clip that every broadcaster will remember for the rest of their career. When you came up with that, I mean, was it spontaneous?
Oh, strictly spontaneous. My only goal was to ask the question. I had prepared a question which was along the lines of, Mr. President, how do you reconcile what you've been saying about these crimes, which are called Watergate, and what the special prosecutor is saying? That was the way. I just wanted to get to the question. It was strictly spontaneous. It was controversial at the time, and frankly, I didn't have time to think about it. I just wanted to get to my question. You know, he had fired his shot. I just kind of wanted to parry it and get on with the question. And as things turned out, as sometimes do, nobody remembers the question, which, by the way, he had no real answer for, but nobody remembers the question or the answer, but they remember that by part. I think, frankly, George, the reason this was memorable in the moment and somewhat since is because the whole situation of this criminal conspiracy led by the president, which we call the shorthand Watergate, was coming to a climax. And this was right near the climactic moment. I think the nation as a whole sensed that. And that was, as part of that context, that's what made it memory.
That's right. That was in March of 74, and he resigned just a few months after that, didn't he?
In August of 74,
yeah.
Yes.
God, what a time that was, Dan, for the nation. And, you know, we haven't stopped yet. I mean, we've gone from that situation to, you know, 9/11, to the situation with ISIS. I mean, it just doesn't stop. How can people take all of this?
Well, people in general, in particular, at the risk of sounding chauvinistic or jingoistic, especially Americans know the value of resilience and persistence. And there is in the American character, look, we're not a perfect people, we're not a perfect country, but there is deep in the American character a sort of sense of, look, whatever happens, just put your head down, your tail up, put one foot in front of the other, and just keep going no matter what happens. And that stood us in very good stead. You're quite right. The reverberations through history are long and lasting of such cataclysmic events as the Kennedy assassination, the criminal events which we call Watergate, 9/11. But, you know, this great historical experiment we know as our beloved United States of America just keeps going. And without being preachy about it, God may it continue for a long, long time.
You have witnessed, you've been a part of reporting on some major events that we've all gone through. How would you categorize them? Outside of the Kennedy assassination, would you say 9/11 was probably the biggest story that you've been involved with as a newscaster, or what would they be?
Well, George, I'm going to try to answer the question, but keep in mind, I said earlier, you know, as a reporter, I've been really lucky and mightily blessed to be on scene, eyewitness to a lot of big stories, and I could make three or four lists for you, but I would say certainly 9/11 would be on any list of most important stories that I have covered. Covering Dr. Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement was another Watergate was certainly mm-hmm. one, covering young Americans in combat, particularly in the green jungle hell that was Vietnam. The list goes on, but in terms of effect on history and the echoes of which still are with us, I would say the civil rights movement, the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, and 9/11.
The business of news these days has changed dramatically, and things have changed it, Dan. I mean, when I was in television news, when you were in television news, the evening news was the newscast. People would come home, they would get the information. Most of it was new and fresh. Nowadays, with all these cable outlets, the cable news outlets, Twitter, instant news, things you pick up on your smartphone, by the time the evening news comes on, it's kind of old news now. Yet the networks really haven't tried to adjust to that yet. How come?
Well, it's because each of the major networks, and we're talking now about maybe five or six, I'm including the major cable networks as well as the over-the-air networks of ABC, NBC, and CBS, that these are very large bureaucracies. And in the nature of bureaucracies, whether you're talking about the Agriculture Department or one of the big networks, the nature of bureaucracies, they get frozen in the past. And where we are with news now, that the news business, the business that can and in the past has underwritten such things as deep digging, investigative reporting, and first-class international overseas reporting, that business model is virtually gone. It's a dinosaur. And news is in what the Catholic Church calls an interregnum. I'm not Catholic, but I like the term. An interregnum is the old order is either gone or going, and the new order is not yet fully in place. And that's pretty much where we are, I think, in the news business. And you're quite right that the fragmentation of the audience, which is to say, they're not the big three networks of ABC and NBC anymore, that they're competitors, everything from Fox to MSNBC to CNN, and the Internet has fragmented the audience to the point that nobody has come up with a business model looking forward that will support the kind of journalism that we had in what I think it was the heyday, the golden period of American news, stretching roughly from about 1960 to sometime in the 1990s. But for your listeners and for consumers of news, I think it's imperative these days that people understand there's probably no one place that you can say, okay, I'm gonna go to that place and that's gonna be the place and maybe the only place or practically the only place to get news. You can't do that. You have to experiment and listen to a lot of different places, even if those places that have a different ideological or partisan political slant than your own. To be well informed, it takes more work now than it once did. You're mm-hmm. quite right that by the time the audience gets around to the evening news, there's a musty sort of feel to it and smell to it. It's news everybody has known something about before the evening gets on, before the evening news gets on. For that reason, George, I think that probably going forward, at least one and maybe more of the major networks will do away with the evening news. And they're all struggling to catch up in the digital world, but they're not doing a very good job of it, and they know it. But in answer to your question, it's because they're such large bureaucracies that they're just very, very slow to move with the times.
Our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Dan Rather. Dan, I've got to ask you this story because you spent your career at CBS. One story crops up, and you had to fight for your career, and they did not back you up, and that was the reporting on 60 Minutes over then former President George Bush's military service. What happened there?
Well, as the saying goes, it's a long story, but in short, what happened is we reported a true story. That story was that a younger George Bush, during the near a height of the Vietnam War, had the essentials of the story were, number one, through his father's influence, he got into a special so-called champagne unit of the Texas Air National Guard as a way to ensure that he would not have to go to Vietnam. Now, that's an unpleasant truth, and there's never been any joy in reporting, but that's a fact. That's important fact one. Important fact two, which we reported, this was the backbone of our story. After he got in the Air National Guard, in the early stages, he performed at least reasonably well, and by some accounts, pretty well. But then, inexplicably, he disappears for a year. He completely disappears for a year. Now, anybody who knows anything about the U.S. military knows you don't disappear from the military for 24 hours, much less a year, without being held accountable for it, and he was not held accountable. Now, we reported that story, and for certain people with ideological and partisan political reasons of their own, they couldn't deny the basic facts of the story, so they attacked the process by which we got to the truth. And we didn't report that the process was not perfect. It rarely is in reporting news. And they managed, and give them credit successfully, to turn the attention away from the facts, the hard truth of the story, to, well, they may have gotten to the truth. This was in paraphrase, if you will. They may have gotten to the truth, but the process was flawed. And as a consequence, the corporate body of Viacom, CBS, was under heavy pressure from the White House and from the power structure in Washington. And they wanted any and everybody associated with the story to go, and so we eventually all went. About as short as I can put it, that was it. I would point out to this day that neither President Bush, former President Bush, nor anyone in his family or his first circle has ever denied the two basic tenets of the story, which I mentioned to you earlier. The story was true. We lost the battle for public opinion on the focal point of, well, in getting to the truth, their process was flawed.
Right. They used the documents, whether they were authentic or not, as their push, and that totally took everyone's attention away from the story, didn't it?
Well, exactly. And let me point out, George, you know, this has all been a long time ago now for me, and is well in my rearview mirror. But to this time on the documents, and mind you, the documents were not the only thing we had. They were, I think it's fair to say, maybe the weakest thing that we had, but they weren't all we had. But to this day, nobody has ever proven that the documents were not what they purported to be. I believed at the time the documents supporting the story were true. I believed it ever since, and I believe it now. Now, I understand there are people who argue, well, nobody has proven they were not what they were supposed to be. However, your job was to prove that they were. I think we did prove it. But what is the measure of truth? Is it beyond any reasonable doubt? We certainly passed that a long time ago, but those who argue that we made a mistake by putting the story in the air, take the other. Well, you have to prove it absolutely. Well, very few things in life can be proven absolutely. But I will say, George, about this. I know that, you know, this story was, in effect, what ended my career at CBS News. And life goes that way sometimes. If you're a reporter, if you're a reporter who takes on tough investigative stories that involve people in powerful positions, you have to face the furnace and take the heat. And in this case, we did face the furnace, take the heat, and metaphorically, it put us down in flames. But after all this time, the two things remain. One, the story was true. And number two, that nobody, the controversial documents, nobody has yet proven that the documents were not what we said they were.
And it took down a lot of good working people, too, with you.
It did. And at this late date, George, someone is asking, well, why shouldn't anybody care about this? It goes to the heart of what you said earlier, how news has changed. That these days, I'm pausing because I want to use the right language, but very big business is in bed big political powers in Washington, whether those powers at any given time be Republican or Democrat. And the big businesses, the huge international corporations that control most of the national and international means of distributing news, they have business that they want to get accomplished in Washington. And of course, the powers that be in Washington, again, in each party, they want sweetheart coverage. They don't want investigative reports where people find out things they don't want them to know. And so I think it's very important for news consumers to understand this is a very important, vital way in which news is now used by major corporations and the powerful in Washington to determine what people get as, quote, news. And that's one reason that deep digging, deep drilling, investigative reporting, and for that matter, first-class international reporting, has declined in the last 5-10 years.
Dan, back in 1978, I picked up Bill Paley's book, As It Happened, and I was working in Minneapolis at the time at a TV station, and I picked up the phone to call his office just to tell him I loved the book, and they actually put me through to him, and he came on the phone, and it was just historical. When you're born going into the broadcast business, I went to the University of Detroit with a broadcast curriculum. It's just amazing to be able to talk to people like the Paleys who created CBS and, you know, helped develop the network structure. Just an amazing story. But things have dramatically changed today, and I don't know if we'll ever go back to what we were. Do you?
I don't know. I certainly would like to think that going forward, we back viewing news as a public service. Bill Paley was not a perfect person. He wasn't a perfect businessman. He made some mistakes. But Bill Paley and the people who owned the major networks at that time were dedicated to the idea that news was a public trust and should be operated in the public service. Their attitude, Paley's attitude and the others was, listen, we have a big business. We're going to make money. But when it comes to news, we're going to view news as a public service. As a consequence of that, news divisions, yes, I believe then and believe now that CBS News was the best of the lot, they had the backing of the corporate owners, and in Paley's case, the founder of the network. And his attitude was, look, I don't like some of the things that news does, but I'm going to build a firewall. Well, what news does, the news people do what they do. We on the corporate side sell time, sell advertising, do entertainment programs, and we view it as a public service, and so we're going to back them. Now, once CBS News was sold, and this is a pattern held for most of the business, once it was sold once and then twice to ever larger corporations, the whole ethos of corporations changed, where news was seen only for the purpose of making money and not as a public trust and a public service. And that's an enormous difference.
Who was your network news president at your time? Was it Burke or Ed Joyce? Who was doing it then?
Well, when I came in, Richard S. Salant, Dick Salant, was the president of CBS News, followed by Fred Friendly. And then after Friendly, Salant came back, and Bill Leonard, and succession Ed Joyce, was for a while, along with Gordon Van Soner during the 80s. Frankly, it got to the point that they changed news division presidents about as often as I
did. Yeah, sure. They did. And Van Soner came out of Chicago, I remember. He was at BBM at the time.
Right.
A lot of giants in the field. You had an opportunity to interview Saddam Hussein a couple times. What did you think of him?
Well, George, if you had been in the room with me, I did the interview twice. The first time was just after he had invaded Kuwait in what I would call Gulf War One. The second time was just not very many hours, a few days at most, before the start of Gulf War Two. If you had been in the room with me the first time and I interviewed him alone, I was by myself in Baghdad Palace, I know that your impression or anybody else's impression would be the same as mine. Number one, no question he was a stone cold killer.
Yes.
No doubt about it.
And his sons were horrible. Horrible.
Absolutely. No question about it. This doesn't deal with whether, the whole question later on, whether he had weapons.
Dan, hold on for a sec. We're already at the top of the hour. This is the fastest interview I've ever had, but we've got one more to go. Dan Rather with us. We'll get into the Saddam Hussein story. Wait till you hear this. In the last half of the show, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to ask Mr. Rather a question. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.